to do is I'd like to have folks that are at the federally qualified health center, I'd like to have you split, because there's about 13 of you, split to three groups of four or five. Okay, there might even be 15 of you by the time people get back. All right, and I'll say that again. So what I'm going to do is have a group over here. Is that okay? A group of four or five. I think there was another big group here, a group of four or five here, and then another group, federally qualified health center, raise your hand. Federally qualified health center. No one back is from a federally qualified. Okay. Do you want to take a group over there of four folks? I think there were 13 or 14 is what we were told. So can you just split yourselves up somewhat evenly? One group there, one group there, and one group over here, okay? And then I'll give you your task. Does that sound good? All right, if you're from a hospital, your behavioral health from the hospital, I'd like to put you all right over. If we can go here, but since there's good, yeah, this will work. Okay, so I was really thinking they're probably in hospital programs where people are in ERs and they're in inpatient units, and then they're outpatient clinics. So again, raise your hand if you're actually in a hospital, like an ER or a trauma center or an inpatient unit. So there's several of you all, right? But you didn't want to raise your hand before. So there'll be four of you right here, okay? There'll be four of you right here. I'll tell you in a sec what the purpose is. So I'm trying to sort of collect organizational systems so that the lessons learned that we formulate can empower those folks who are in those systems to think about how to change that system and also to change patient care. So we'll get there in a sec. I'll give you a pass, okay? If you're in an outpatient clinic of some sort, raise your hand. Okay. I'd like you to meet right here with these folks. If you are in some other type of context that I haven't mentioned, tell me what that is. No. Health coaches go within their system of care. So if you're in the hospital, you go to the hospital, folks. If you're in an outpatient clinic, you go. Does that sound? Okay. Did I miss any kind of, because I can imagine community healthcare centers, I think I talked about, we can call those outpatient clinics. Okay? So I'm trying to divide you by system of care. So did I miss you? Did I miss some folks who aren't in it? You're FQHC, so you'll go with it, an FQHC group. I think you want to go with the group. Whoever has the least. No, so the three of you going as a triad. You do tracking. Okay. All right, so let me give you your task. All right, so once you're in your group, once you're in your group, you got to let me give you your task. So get into your group. I'm going to give you just a couple minutes to say hello if you don't know each other, and you'll start with that. Introduce yourselves, okay? Give your roles. You probably do, you know, you might have similar roles. Or
trying to get them here.
And then here's the challenge. Here's your first challenge.
That's the exit.
Yeah, no.
Need you to come up with the top three barriers to what makes your work, the top three barriers to what makes your work hard to accomplish in that system of care. So if you, when you think of your work being to implement ESCRD with the number of screens that is approximate what should be, quote unquote, happening, as was shown by data from Rita and also Matthew's presentation, the question is, what are the top three barriers for each of you in that system that don't allow that to happen? Does that make sense? Everybody? And so just take 5 minutes to work on that. They probably are going to be in different domains. So think about them. If you need help with that, I can help you think about what those barriers are like. Well, as a group, individually, you're going to say yours. And you're going to see if there's a collective theme around that barrier. That makes sense? And then as a group, you'll come up and say, okay, in your rank order. So if you come up with five barriers as a group, it's okay. You can actually say all five. But then what we're going to do, obviously, is look towards solutions. But let's just stay with this at first. So you're going to brainstorm top 3 to 5 challenges or barriers within that system of care, okay, to implement ESPR.
All right, so here's what I want to do now. I want to try to do a debrief where we just get at some of those challenges so folks can hear them, and your abilities to sort of give some feedback or some solutions, because there might be some cross-fertilization here. What works in one domain already might be helpful in another. So let's just hear. Let's try to hear. I'm going to start with Pat, who they actually cleverly disguise their challenges as three. But go ahead and somebody be the reporter of those.
Okay.
Say where you primarily working in that.
Well, most of us are most were health coaches. Some of us are from Springfield. Some of us are from here in Columbia. But we disguised our first two into one, and that is politics. So 1 and 2, politics of the organization, where we are, and the third was medical providers, and more specifically, delivery system.
Okay. And so when I think of the word politics, I mean, I'm sort of thinking of where the power and the funding is. I don't know. So what would you describe more in your own words than you mean?
Well, part of it was like an outside agency coming in. You know, because you know, we were working with another agency to implement these programs. So part of it was an outside agency coming in. And just one way to put it is a prior working relationship with that agency.
So you mean MIMHs?
No. Yes, Springfield. Okay, I'm with a behavioral health. Actually, subcontracted by MIMH or behavioral health. And we went into a hospital setting. And so you have a lot of dynamics going in there with being behavioral health, substance abuse going into an ER setting. Plus the general politics between the two big agencies, which would be my mental health and the hospital system. But I'm not going there.
So, do folks hear that? It's a little hard to hear without the mic probably, but would you summarize it like a nutshell version?
Basically, politics between, like I said, we're not MIMH, we were subcontracted by MIMH, and we're behavioral health. Going into a different agency, which was the hospital ER setting, a lot of different politics, whether it's all the way up, down to the ER setting itself, and accepting behavioral health and substance use with medical.
It would be good to have a whiteboard, because we don't have one, we're just going to have to assume. So politics, and it sounds like previous relationships and right previous organizational relationships. And then medical care, provider resistance, meaning they just would not accept that it was a good idea to do ESPR. Right? Challenging to get them to implement. Okay, I'm going to turn by. I know there's another group here, right?
We are from a federally qualified healthcare facility. Have some more Rogers and so on. We talked about one of the barriers that we talked was the training and pre-screening process for the support staff, and so then they're not being done.
Or not done well.
There's no consistency. If they were trained, maybe it's not being done the way it should be,
yeah.
And there's no consistency in that. The staff-patient ratio is another barrier that we put here. And if there was a positive pre-screening, the succeeding, you know, steps to get to the behavioral health consultant is also the processes.
The process, the workflow.
The workflow, yeah.
All right. So training, workflow, and the first was the
Screening.
actually administering it. Not, it's presented. It's not a matter of they don't present
it. Or not presented well enough.
Or not presented well enough. Okay. That's a little different.
In our group, we echo the physicians aren't bought in. Well, we are outpatient family clinics, so we echo that. And within the physicians not being bought in, they feel like you're going to run the patients off. Either that's an invasion of their privacy, or you're going to make their appointment take too long. And so we also have some people that are part of rural clinics versus just within the area. So the education of the clinics and the geographical barriers. So sometimes the health coaches or the BHCs or whoever are doing it are stretched too thin. One has like 150 miles between the clinics, so they can't just go and there's only one person for so many clinics. So there are not enough health coaches in the area, so patients needing intervention are often missed. And then not everybody is screening consistency, the general population versus like the home medical population. Nurses are not notifying the BACs or health coaches of the positive referrals. And so then again, we're missing people who need interventions and possible, at one clinic, there's possible HIPAA violations. So privacy within the organization, patients are concerned about this going to their insurance company. We're fast and efficient.
Well, the issue is you all have to bring up solutions.
Fast and sufficient, efficient to do that as well.
So we're from federally qualified health centers at this table, and we concur with all of these barriers that have been spoken about. So this is a really good dialogue. I'm Access Family Care, and we're actually the ones that were pilot have shown that we are not performing. So we do have a lot of barriers, and one of them, we said we're in pre-contemplation. I love what you said. 18 months ago, we got tasked to do NCQA, the APCP program, and the Missouri Health Net Health Home. We didn't even know what it was. So we're learning the language, we're learning what it's all about, we're hiring staff who don't even know their roles yet, and then we're putting all of this on to all of our staff and providers. So right now our clinical staff, our MAs and LPNs it takes them 30 minutes to room a patient, because not only do they have ESPRT, they have all the UDS measures that they have to go click, 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 from eye exams to monofilament exams to foot exams to LDLs to weight, to waist circumference, to BMI, to teaching weight management, nutrition, exercise, aspirin, statin. I'm a nurse practitioner and the health home director, and it is amazingly difficult to train all these factors. So yes, what the MA does is, you don't drink alcohol, do you? You don't use drugs, do you? You have no HIV risk. You do wear sunscreen. You exercise 30 minutes a day. And they have to do this because their provider's angry because the patient is being held up to be roomed, and the provider's saying numbers, 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 numbers. So right now we're imploding. We just applied for NCQA. We have four clinics 150 miles apart, two BHCs who have to travel. And we have four resignations on the table from providers. We're about to self-destruct because we're not sustainable in this model. So there's a lot of issues. And I agree with you know, trying to stretch these ladies so thin. They can't go to all the clinics. So, and then our EMR, to get the ESPRT into the EMR took 4 months to get it. We have two IT people amongst four clinics. So to get it into the EMR, and then to try to come up with a report that shows the positive screens is another thing. It's going to be the $100,000 and the, you know, I mean, it's phenomenally difficult to get the EMR change. So we can't run a report on the positives, so they don't know who their positives are. So then the process of getting them a positive so they can do the treatment and the therapy on them is very difficult. So, yeah, we have a lot of work to do, and I like this venue where FQs can sit together and say, what are your barriers, and how can we just learn a better way to do huddles, because NCQA requires huddles. So she was telling us a better way to do our huddles. We need dialogue about the barriers so that we can be successful.
The only clarification I want to make to that, which is very eloquently put, is real. You said you're pre-contemplative in a way, and it didn't sound, it sounded to me like you're motivated to do these things. It's just there's demands on the system and it hasn't caught up with the demands. But in terms of your attitude, you didn't mean attitude.
Is the providers don't see the value of this. That's the pre-contemplative.
But you are one of the providers. You are a provider.
I am a provider, but I'm like a fish going the other way.
So
show for Ada at our next meeting to say this works.
So I see. So there's some of you in the agency that are pre-contemplative, and some are really not, in terms of attitude. It really reminded me, and I guess we'll say it now, I wanted to make, well, we can wait until the last barriers have been spoken, and then we'll go to the next phase. Do you all have any to add to the list of barriers?
I mean, pretty much what everyone else said, and Catherine, being a health coach, probably summed it up what we have experienced over the past 4 years.
All right. The same way.
We are from an assortment of QHCs, I believe. I think, did you say you're a hospital-based, but the majority of us are QHC-based. And I think everybody can relate to some of the things that have been said. What we pulled up, we talked about organizational issues and kind of buy-in on both the personal level of the people doing the administration of the pre-screens and the assists, and organizationally how much support / pressure is being pushed down to make sure these things are done in the appropriate way. We also spoke about communication. We worded it communication to coordinate care, but I think that's from a handoff within a clinic from the MA or the LPN who've done the pre-screen and passes it off to the assist, how much communication is done there. And then we even spoke about if there's barriers to like a phone call after an appointment to do the full assist over the phone, and maybe a homeless population may not have access to the phone or have the minutes or be willing to share that information. And then just the big one I think everybody can relate to is time. Squeezing so much into that visit and trying not to keep the patient there all day, because for every minute they stay, we back up 5 minutes for something else. So. A lot of similar challenges, a few different ones. So, the task now for me is to try to say very quickly in your group, right, brainstorm one or two possible steps that you think could be the antidote to those barriers or challenges. So just brainstorm. I wouldn't edit it too much, but, you know, because some things would have come out. And they can even be wishful thinking, as we'll say, right? It could be wishful thinking, but go ahead and brainstorm maybe. And if it's a wishful thinking list, then have at least one you think is actually reality. Something that could happen in the next 3 to 6 months that would change what some of those barriers look like. Okay, so just quickly come up with some anecdotes. Alright, so let's come back. Let's do this quickly because we're actually going to try to get out of 11:30. So let's just... Catherine's always a good person to start because she's fast. She'll let us know. So you got two anecdotes? A couple anecdotes? A couple anecdotes people got? Well, it's okay. So I'll just start because I'm right here. We'll start with Catherine. So now, I don't know who's recording this, because this is really important. I'm certainly thinking about it.
That's the reason you were speaking into the microphone.
Speak into the microphone? Okay.
So we just looked at a couple real quick. For the physician buy-in, take the positive information back to show it works at the faculty meetings or meetings. The other with that is compare them to their colleagues. A lot of them don't like the shame factor when they're doing worse or their outcomes are worse than others. So make sure you praise the ones who are doing well and make sure you show their outcomes. And then so you can say, and Dr. Such and Such, who isn't doing the program, here are their results. So that kind of makes them want to step up to be like the colleagues who are. And also then being stretched too thin, basically, and there just needs to be more of a BHC, so to speak, but we need to not limit who can fill or define them within a BHC. So right now it's kind of limited to like LCSWs who can fill, but they're like previous of some of us who are health coaches who have been doing this could easily step into the roles, but we don't have the power to fill, so nobody would hire you.
So you want to open up the Medicaid codes. You're saying somehow legislate opening up the Medicaid codes, and that's political.
In the rural areas, you can't find those.
You need the resources. Yeah. And it's not a matter of knowledge base at that point, or expertise. It's literally a matter of a title. Right? That's what you're saying. So is that a turf war, too? Is it some turf war in there?
I don't think so. I think in rural Missouri, you're not going to find... There's not that many licensed
clinics. So there's it's not like people are trying to exclude you. It's just they didn't write this into the codes.
I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, in New York State, there are states that have written very liberal codes.
We're hoping with the expert folks that we can broaden that and include more people. So. Well, Dr. Parks has asked us to come up with a training and a certification for people to see and also who would be eligible to provide the service. So he'll go to Medicaid with that and we'll see what happens. But I do know the Primary Care Association is probably still going to stick with LCSW and psychologists, is that it? That can provide the HVAI services. Right, but hopefully with ESPRT we'll try to keep it broader.
So I have a question that you would like to have a separate code for ESPRT services other than health that behavior course, right?
Correct. There are already separate codes nationally. There's SBI codes and then there's HBAI codes. If you go to the website, if you go to ESPRT, Rita has the paper posted on there of the study we did of the 50 states showing who's got it funded, how much they're getting and reimbursed and that kind of thing.
And it has the codes too.
Yes, it has the codes.
And you know, this is along the lines of sustaining the model, so I just... Who's you?
We actually had two, but I'm going to explain one and then she'll explain the other one for us. One that we said and one that's worked for us across the board is finding somebody who's not at the very top, but somebody who's well-liked by their peers. So, for example, nurses. You know, there's a couple people that are liked by everybody. We really sell it to them. Then they have that buy-in, and then it just kind of trickles across the board, and there's more interest. And I think you can do it at the provider level as well, but you have to have somebody interested. And so just some of the basic relationships that we've made have helped us kind of get our foot in the door in several locations.
I had more of a baby step because in my... Further away? Okay. In my experience working with doctors and nurses, it's kind of like, it's been like I'm playing baseball in their basketball court. So to bridge that has been real difficult and actually seemed kind of hopeless. But when Wynn was talking the other day about the power of the word, it empowered me. Like, I can watch my language and not call it a dirty UA. Approach it as a disease, a disease process, and in that way, maybe change the way other people think about it. And that's something that I can do right now. And I don't know, it just gave me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I mean, if you're from the social work field or the psychology field, you know that a lot of times you call your patients client, and right? And when you're in the medical field, it might behoove you to call them patients, right? When you're talking to providers that are medical, because that also is a division. You know, really. So I think that language is important. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I definitely think education, we're going to take back the slides from the ESPER results and present them to providers. We need evidence-based practice for this, and I think that shows very powerfully that this is successful. And then education, we talked about communication and education of staff on a regular basis. You don't just teach a diabetic one time. You have to go back, and they have to allow you to do lunch and learns or something to continue education with the staff on the how to ask the questions, why we do this, so it's not a dirty new way, that it's something positive that the staff can get behind.
And Dylan.
Changing the billing codes,
is that basic?
Do you want the mic?
I don't need
them. You do need the mic. Matthew will come.
We also talked about finding a person of influence and just working with that one person, hoping that someone well-liked in the clinic can spread the word. And I'm proud of that because where I work and where these ladies have been working, we're getting a new medical director. So I'm hoping someone can influence that person, and under the assumption that this is what we all have to do now, behavioral health and primary care are now integrated. It's what is done under the Healthcare Reform Act. It has to happen. So, you know, starting fresh with a new person, I'm hoping will make a difference in that.
Let me add something here. This group here had talked about lunch and learns or keeping training going.
If you go to MoSPIRT website, and we're going to make sure both things are on both websites, also ESPIRT, there's a lot of training materials. We've done a training video on how to ask the question, so you could show that to new staff or existing staff, and there's other videos on there too that you could use for lunch and learns or something along those lines.
One of the things we talked about as far as some consistency and whatnot and how to deal with some of these issues. We talked about asking the questions every time, even if we're not putting it into the ESPIRT system, just making it such a regular part of the rooming process. And then we kind of deal with whether we can track it later or not, but just making it not brainless, but kind of just automatic. What else do we talk about as some solutions or stuff, guys?
Transferring from after you get a positive to getting a BHC to follow up, having like a face sheet printed so that it makes it easier to get into the electronic system, the ESPIRT.
I do think sometimes having some turnovers, as scary as that can be in a clinic, it does kind of, if you set up a policy, it kind of gives you a chance that the new team members kind of get on board with the policy that currently exists and don't have to deal with the change.
So, great antidotes. I mean, you know, I could also say that bribes can work too, so just remember that if you might need to bribe the person on top, think of that new medical director coming in, somebody take that person out to dinner early and where. Bruce, would you, I know you don't like being put on the spot, but I'm going to do that. When you all were talking about your challenges, whether it's at a patient level or whether it's at a programmatic level, you know, you start thinking, so what does it really take? What does it take from an individual to help sustain change? And he came up with these three words that I think I found in the research actually around what makes people successful in times of change or hardship.
The four words are patience, persistence, and adaptive resilience. But that's really, you know, those are good things to think about for life in general, not just for implementing projects. But it applies to both change at the organizational level and at the patient care level. It's the same thing. It's the same qualities that you're looking for.
So patience, persistence.
Adaptive resilience, which means that everybody's going to fail. Failure is just part of life, and what really separates us is our ability to respond to that and overcome it. So.
Yeah, my response back to was there's some new research on what makes people successful, athletes, you know, musicians, and this psychologist from Stanford came up with this term, grittiness. And grittiness is, that's exactly the words that would describe grittiness. Is sticking it, you know, just sticking in there with these challenges, and then, you know, you pick it up over time. So I was tasked with just, in fact, I think you guys did a great job, and, you know, I'm going to try to get, if that, those were written down, I'm going to try to get a copy of that to think about as we move forward in Vermont. There's some new group cohorts doing ESPR, and it'll be helpful to have that, those antidotes and those challenges, and try to think about them sooner. So I have the fortune of working with the technical assistance provider to ESPR on a national level. And so Bruce wanted me to talk about, they wanted me to talk about what are some of the trends nationally for this same, for ESPR as a protocol that you've been doing with alcohol and drugs, and sort of where is it going and how is it going to merge based on politics and funding from CSAT and CHAMSA, what is their thinking? And so I wrote down some information. I mean, we know that it's diffused, and it's clear that it's diffused here in Missouri quite well. You guys have diffused the model across different levels of care and different healthcare environments, and that's clearly happening nationally at a similar level. I started to think about the training environments and the grant that Bruce and Ms. Yu applied for, which was pretty much, I think, a residency training grant initially, right? Has really morphed into, they didn't really want you to write a residency training grant. They wanted you to write a grant for counselors, social workers, and nurse practitioners. And so that same exact funding literally switched to different domains so that it would spread across the system of care. So that your staff coming in, hopefully on a graduate school level, will already have the language of ESPR and understand. So when you go to train them in your agencies, they'll already have some background knowledge. So that effort is underway, and I think that's a potentially really helpful one. We were given the mission of coming up with a co-occurring treatment manual to be used in ESPR, and that manual has been written. It's probably about 95% completed, and we're now trying to do the final draft for that, and it's likely that there'll be equal brief treatment trainings alongside that, and not only will there be brief treatment trainings for co-occurring training, and what they did is they took the manual actually from Missouri, so you should be happy about that. They took the manual from Connecticut, and they took the ESPR manual from Massachusetts, and they basically took the best of those chapters in those manuals that were written with your project, right, and Missouri had a large part of it. And then they combined them, and then we added certain chapters and certain training modules. So you all should feel proud that that will come out, and that means that you'll have another resource that will be manuals. But, you know, manuals, I mean, just so you know, these manuals tend to sit on shelves. And so this one is not for, I mean, we're hoping that there'll be enough handouts and clinical material that it will really be utilized in sessions with folks. And it's written that way, but that's part of our implementation strategies. And so that goes back to integrated treatment approaches. The other thing that's happening on states' levels is that ESPR is happening in cardiology practices. It's starting to sort of, as a mindset, a cultural mindset, it's sort of starting to reach out anywhere where people come in for a referral for some kind of either behavioral health or medical issue and need an intervention. And so the two places that I can think of right away that that's happening are in criminal justice settings, right? And I think I put, yeah, criminal justice, and also court diversion. So many states are changing the way they look at marijuana possession. And so therefore there's whole new protocols around decriminalizing a marijuana possession. And what that does is it opens up an avenue for an ESPR protocol. And so what Vermont is doing, I can just say from my personal experience, is Vermont has said for any youth that gets a possession of marijuana, they're given the choice of either some kind of a criminal fine and they lose their license, or they can come into court diversion. I'm assuming Missouri probably has a court diversion process as well. And so what you're going to see is that court diversion process is now opening up and they're expanding room for interventions. And so what they're saying is that they're going to do a brief screen, and you know, they wish they had something like the Audit or the DAS for youth. They don't actually, they have the CRAF. How many of you have heard of the CRAF tool for youth? That's a 6-question screen designed for medical settings, very effective for adolescents, but it's just a substance use. Many people want to do a more complete one, and so they're typically using something called the GAIN-SS, which is a 20-question, it's the Global Appraisal of Individual Needs short screener, the GAIN-SS. And there's a web version, it's also very brief, it can be used for adolescents. There's some other tools I could talk about, but after that tool, they're literally going to do the technique that you all do, which is the brief intervention. That they're designing a reflective discussion or feedback report to go along with the output of the tool, and they'll talk to the youth in that way, and the family, if they can enlist the family, and then they'll have, that their condition will be some kind of follow-up on some kind of an educational program or just the intervention itself, just going through the intervention. There's still a fine process. Yeah.
Are these ESPER follow-up brief sessions computer-based? Do you have to hook things in the computer?
You don't, I mean, you're asking a good question. Do we want them to be automated? We do. Are they computer-based? No. So much of it is really the relationship between the individual. And so the screening tools are very brief. And then the outcome of that report is really maybe a one-page piece of paper. But we know there are certain themes in that reflective discussion that make it individual and powerful, and that's what we try to train, right? It's the themes of the discussion. And what you reminded me of is, if you're going to get into this realm, one place to look is at something called the Teen Marijuana Checkup, and that was out of the University of Washington. It's on the web. It's a very, very powerful show to really help you. And because of the rise in marijuana use that we're seeing, it's good to be familiar with that protocol. But it's a very much an ESPER protocol. That's what it is at its heart. And the power is in how they talk to the teens about the information, just like you're doing with alcohol and drugs. And then, you know, this same ESPER, one of the best manuals that was written early on in 2000, probably maybe a little earlier, was by Marlack Dimash, and it's called Basics. And that's the brief alcohol college screening intervention. And it's really for college students, it's for that age. And that's also where ESPER has become pretty much the state of the art in dealing with alcohol use on campus. It's very much an ESPER intervention. So for the folks here who see the grand ending, after the years, there's probably some sadness, and you know, maybe even there's now you have to think, okay, where is my skill set? Where can I look in the field of healthcare or even criminal justice? Where can I look to apply these same strategies and skills that I've gotten in other domains? And that's really opening up. Well, that's opened up as a society. I think ESPER has sort of carved the terrain that the Affordable Care Act, these tools that we're all seeing are effective will come into play. And there will be job opportunities out there. I don't have a whole lot more to add to that. I think there's a promise. I don't know if the actual ESPER management team was shaking his head no. Would you all like to add anything? Any questions or comments about the next choice?
Just while I was sitting here listening to you and we did this exercise, I don't know what kind of training the doctors actually get, but going back to the, I'm not good with numbers, what's the statistic on dollars spent on this and the dollar saved?
Anywhere from 1 to 4 and 1 to 5. I see there's like 7 places in terms of societal costs.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think
I was just thinking about how it might be helpful to put a face on that. Like, if we have all these pamphlets, maybe we should have a pamphlet for the doctors. Like, you know, what difference does it make if I did an intervention? And then have some specifics, like, you know, it helps diabetes patients be more compliant. I mean, I really don't know the answer to that question. But, you know, to make it, to bring it home to their everyday practice, how it's helping them in the practice.
It's not just the doctor, it's the CEO.
So there's a couple of marketing campaign ideas coming out now, and that's what I think you're really talking about, Virginia, is how do you give this marketing to give it some traction? And there are some pretty successful campaigns where people literally one day in the office, they just print out signs. When does $1 equal $4? They just put that up on the wall, literally. When does $1 equal $4? And they don't say a word about the answer. They have everybody thinking, what is this about? When, as you can see, we've done 1 equals 4. And then, like, you know, the next day, people are going around, what does this mean? And what do you think? And it's like, oh, maybe 1 out of 4 people have, you know, get some kind of disease, and who knows what will come up. But then the next day, you could put, you know, 1 intervention equals $4 saved. So there's a way of doing the marketing campaign that can sort of draw attention into it. And there's a guy at Rutgers University who's been very successful around addictions on college campus doing that. With normative data.
Just to say exactly, specifically, how is money saved?
Yeah.
Not just that saved.
Well, you know, that's pretty interesting, though, when they look. It's really the cost of those emergency room visits, it's doctor times, it's cost, you know, so it's a little more amorphous. I mean, it's a little more amorphous. They could put savings in doctor times, time away from work, time for job. But still, your thought about marketing is really important at the level of the psychological level. Any other questions or comments? Remember grit. You all have to remember grittiness, because that's really what it's going to take to sustain any of this and implement it.